that made Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath look like a wine festival.
Finally, William Barr, the current Attorney General, the Attorney General under George H.W. Bush. We just have a minute, but as you wrap up, Roberto, what is his connection to this story?
William Barr, as Attorney General under the first Bush, redeployed FBI resources and the greatest deployment of FBI resources up to that point, taking FBI agents who were fighting looking at foreign threats, and started focusing them on gangs. And then he starts looking at MS-13 and other gangs right after the LA riots. You can see he was there in LA, and he started us on the path to eventually militarizing the police that we have right now. And then he then also had the INS deport the gang problem to El Salvador, and then he exported after the war U.S. style policing, and then I found out that military trainers from El Salvador actually came to train LAPD in counterinsurgency and other police forces. It's just when you start seeing the robocopization of cop uniforms, right, and that we have now. And William Barr had everything to do with, he had a lot to do with this. I had to sing his song because he deserves all the credit he deserves for what he did to El Salvador and to LA and to our national situation long before Trump.
Roberto Lovato, there is
You are
so
listening
much
to
more.
KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 o'clock. It's second Wednesday. It's time for the Wednesday Talk Radio program with your hosts, Paul Rowland and Jacqueline Keeler. Stay tuned.
Hold your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your eyes on the earth. Lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damage?
And good morning, everybody. It is once again the second Wednesday of the month, and my co-host Jacqueline Keeler will be up with us in just a few minutes. I've got a few things to say first regarding the station, but even before that, my thoughts go out to all those who have been impacted by these fires that are coming oh so close to home now, including within our listening area. I'm talking about the Salem area, east of Salem, the Santiam River drainage, Mackenzie River area. A former neighbor of mine moved down to Blue River, and that community was devastated, I'm sorry to say, yesterday. And we're thinking of some people who are unaccounted for down towards Opal Creek. We're thinking of the Opal Creek area. Heard a report that possibly Jawbone Flats was destroyed. Don't have final confirmation on that. Anyway, just it's a heavy time, and we're all feeling it. And stay safe, be careful, and all that. And on that note, also in terms of a disaster, dealing with disasters, I'm thinking of KBOO Radio and the importance of community radio as we are in our summer, late summer, fall membership drive. And I remember not long after I came back to Portland in 2012 and started doing KBOO again, I did some programs on the importance of community radio. One of the things I hadn't known was how many community stations are really the official emergency response station, either the principal or backup, or just play a vital role, especially in rural communities, but not only, in letting people know about wildfires, hurricanes, and other natural disasters, and of course, about things like police shootings and response to thereof. And so, yeah, as you, as we're all dealing with these intense times, think about the importance of community radio. As a listener and member supported station, we obviously depend on your financial support, but that's not the only way you can help us. You can also talk us up among your friends and acquaintances in case they don't already know about KBOO. Tell them about some of the programs you listen to and how important you think KBOO is. You don't have to proselytize, but we are trying to add 250 new members during this drive, so that's one way you can help us out. In addition, if you are able in these financial crunch times, to contribute directly by going to kboo.fm/drive/donate. As I said, you can also spread the word and help increase our listenership and our membership. That's what these membership drives are all about. We don't have phone lines because of COVID, but you can donate, as I said, to our website, kbo.fm, or through the good old U.S. Post Office, which also needs your support now more than ever. Send us a check or money order to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. We are here for you, 52 years and counting. Okay, with that, good morning, Jacqueline. Hello?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're loud and clear.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. So we're going to be talking once again about this time of historical reckoning, challenging the dominant white supremacist Eurocentric narrative of United States history, wherever it rears its ugly head, which is most places. In particular, we're going to be talking about some more, another stat, one that a colleague has been fighting against. But before we do that, you've got some fires over on your side of the West Hills, don't you? And I'm not too far away. There's one near Forest Grove, I think.
Yeah, there have been a few. It's pretty... it looks very autumnal out, like that sort of light. And yeah, it's been pretty crazy, I think. We've just been sort of keeping the windows closed and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, I hear there's been brush fires and structure fires also around the Portland area. So I guess the wind has died down now, so presumably the threats are lessening. But yeah, what's up? I know you went to... we're talking about George Rogers Clark, the a very grotesque statue honoring him in Charlottesville, Virginia. So I know you went back there last year. You were invited by Guy Lopez, who is one of the people involved in this struggle at the University of Virginia, to remove that statue and in its place put an Indigenous study center. So it takes up an incredible amount of space, that particular statue, which I guess is an appropriate metaphor. Talk about the what you know about that statue and this whole process.
Yeah, so I was invited to come out to the University of Virginia last year in Charlottesville, and it was quite moving to come there, particularly after the Nazi the sort of neo-Nazi riots there shortly before, and it was and we went and looked at the statue, and I took some photographs of it, and it's a statue. It's not actually located in a very large area. It's actually located sort of on a Charlottesville is a sort of quaint almost New England type town, it's in Virginia, but sort of this and it's on this sort of narrow little road that over there on the other side are these little shops and stuff, and so it's I think it used to be more prominent in the 1920s when it was put up. The trees have all grown up around it. It's sort of just on the side of the road there. And I think they want to build the center somewhere else. They had some powwow grounds that they had on the campus where they used to have the annual powwow, but that is now being utilized too. They were creating a monument to the enslaved Black Americans who built the university. The university was designed by Thomas Jefferson, and Monticello is just not that far away. It's just down the road, a few miles. And so it has a very neoclassical, architecture similar to the president's home. And so like the White House, it was built with people who were in bondage, right? Being held in bondage. So they're building a monument there to those people. And so when I was there, and Guy, of course, he's Crow Creek. I think he's Dakota, or is it Lakota? but anyway, so most people from Crow Creek are Dakota. But he works there in Virginia. He's worked there for many years, and before that, he was teaching in Arizona. So it's interesting to be in a place where there are the presence of Native Americans is even less, because of genocide of dry, and of course figures like this figure, George Rogers Clark, are a big part of that. He's called he's called the conqueror of the Northwest. And when they are discussing the Northwest in Virginia at that time, when he lived in that period, they are talking about the Northwest being the Ohio Valley, which is the colony Virginia had a claim to under their original charter with the crown, with the British crown, right? And so they were constantly sending kind of troops and things out there. And of course George Washington famously was sent as a Virginia officer to the Ohio Valley, and he actually was involved in a skirmish that ended up with the killing of a French diplomat, to which he signed a letter in French, which he couldn't read, that basically admitted his own guilt and actually started the very first World War, what they call World War Zero, or what we call in the United States the French and Indian War, in which in Europe is called the Seven Years' War. And so they were constantly trying to protect their interests in that area. So this is why George Rogers Clark was in the Ohio Valley, trying to put down, or he pushing out and fighting the Shawnee and the Mingos, who were a Seneca band that didn't want to be part of the Six Nations, so they had moved to Ohio. And he's being memorialized here. There are the monument was paid for by a man named Paul Goodloe McIntyre. He's the same wealthy individual who in the 1920s put up three other statues in Charlottesville, including the Robert E. Lee statue, which was the center of the protests and riots that ended in the death of one young woman. And these were his own initiatives. They were not done. There was no popular vote, or it wasn't a civic project per se officially. And he also put up statues to Stonewall Jackson, and also one of Meriwether Lewis, William Clark, and Sacagawea. And William Clark, of Lewis and Clark fame, that is his older brother, George Rogers Clark. They're from the same family. And so the statue of George Rogers Clark has a lot more people in it, and including Native people and a Native woman and child who are being, he's on a big horse, charging horse, and the Native woman and child are behind him, crouching down in a submissive state, sort of thing. And so it's very, it's very triumphant. It's very what today we would regard as incredibly brutal and insensitive. It's a celebration of this. And he was actually encouraged in this by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson once wrote a letter to Clark and saying that the best way to deal with Native people was total repression, suppression of savage insolence and cruelty. So they were what he was doing and putting and this sort of act of genocide against the people of the Ohio Valley, this was fully supported by the power structures in Virginia at the time. And although George Rogers Clark did not entirely benefit, he came back and he had actually helped to underwrite a lot of it with his own income, and so he ended up in debt and then impoverished. So it's sort of interesting, but yeah, it was recently painted red with red paint in August, and then also the George Rogers Clark was. The statue was nearly decapitated, and so there are, of course, our friend Guy is part of a committee that has suggested to the university that they take down the statue and they replace it with a somewhere on campus. That area is not actually, I don't know if it's large, and it didn't seem very large area to me at the time when I was there, but to find out space for a Native American. Study center and to to encourage because it is I have to say I was educated I went to college in New Hampshire, and it's strange to go to these places as someone who's from very large Native nations in the West. It is strange to go back and find that to be in a place where Native people are so disappeared, where you're in a place where genocide has happened, where it's complete in a way that is really quite, as a Native person, is really everything you fear. It's hard to exist in spaces like that. I mean, and you see this whole culture has arisen and has forgotten Native people and is going about its business. And the only sort of way of remembering Native people are place names, right? And so they're almost like grave markers of entire peoples, all using all of these Native names as names for towns and things like that, and rivers, and it's just sort of it's very horrific. And so talking to folks at the University of Virginia, and a guy had brought me in with a group whom we were able to talk directly to the provost and to a lot of the administrators of the university, and is to realize that they don't understand. To a large extent, even these people, very highly educated people, live in a vacuum of knowledge. I've spoken at Virginia a couple times in the past few years. In 2018, I was invited out to speak at the College of William and Mary, which is in Williamsburg. And of course, that's right down the road from Jamestown. And when I was there in 2018, it was right after several Virginia tribes were finally given federal recognition. Including Pocahontas' tribe, the Powhatan tribe, and it was very interesting. These tribes that were the initial sort of, because Jamestown was the first, really the first English settlement that took, and so this is where that interaction first occurred between the English and the indigenous nations. And so it was really, and I got to know that these tribes are just who remains, right? Are finally getting federal recognition, but talking to people from Virginia was an interesting experience. And talking to students from Virginia, because most of the universities are primarily Virginians, and even the College of William and Mary, which is a private college, most of the students are from Virginia. And they don't know a lot about history, but even their own history, they don't understand. Have a very good framework to understand it, because they have these little sayings, Virginia, like Virginia is for lovers, or Virginia is the birthplace of democracy. But when you talk about the history of Virginia, is where racism was created, where the whole construct we live with now of whiteness was first sort of articulated here. I mean, we talk about history, but we often are told when we're taught history, and particularly ancient history, that they didn't have the concept of race that we have. Like the Romans, didn't have this concept of whiteness. It was, you were Roman, you were an imperial citizen, or you were a barbarian, right? There was a different construct going on. And of course, in Europe before then, it was really about being Christian, right? And so we often try to project these racist ideas, and you see that in groups like white supremacist groups, particularly if you have the unfortunate experience of being referred by Google to Stormfront or something like that. You see these really, they're trying to apply this modern concept of race to ancient societies where it didn't really exist. But it was created in Virginia in response to the unification of white indentured servants and black people stolen from Africa and held in bondage. These two groups actually unified pretty early on and held a rebellion and a Bacon's rebellion. And so they were able, there was a lot of dissatisfaction because the planters had gotten all the best land, new people coming in were unable to obtain land. And so these two groups unified and had a rebellion in the 1600s. And it was at this point that the planters, the elite class, then devised the concept of this divide and conquer strategy to divide those two groups from each other by giving, they're primarily, British people from the British Isles who were held in indentured servitude, to giving them rights and not giving them to folks who had been taken from Africa. And so this is the origin of a lot of what we are still dealing with today. But when I presented this history to the students, at William & Mary, they were shocked. They had never thought of they never were taught that concept. What the meaning of that rebellion really was about. And then when you're looking at the University of Virginia, they still have this incredible sort of reverence for Thomas Jefferson, right? And everything is like they live encased in sort of buildings that he constructed that came from his mind. There is this whole like worshipfulness towards him. And so when I was talking to the provost and the other university leaders, I think that, I reminded them of Virginia's role in starting the First World War, which sometimes people don't really remember that very well. Like George Washington was like 20, 21 years old. He was very young. He was leading a party and he got caught up and he ended up creating this Fort Necessity and getting overrun by the French. So the French were building forts to firm up their claims to that land. And so the Virginians felt threatened. And so they sent up George Washington and other folks and then accidentally murdered a French diplomat, which was a international incident, right? So they don't understand that, you talk about the land companies that folks like Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and Meriwether Lewis's father was very involved in, and the Clarks and everyone, these were land companies, corporate entities, the corporate structure that created the colony of Virginia, which, of course, we've discussed on the show before, which was really the engine that led to the land lust in the Ohio Valley, the destruction and genocide, which this statue celebrates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a few things that I wanted to pick up on. One is reading here that Clark's military career began in 1774, as you were talking about, when he served as a captain in the Virginia militia and was preparing to lead an expedition of 90 men down the Ohio River when hostilities broke out between the Shawnee and settlers on the Kanawha frontier, which eventually culminated in what they call Lord Dunmore's War, which is part of that 7 years war. And I think I may have said this on my show, but part of this, historical reckoning for us Euro descendants is to learn about our own, the general history, of course, but our own particular family history. And actually, the first ancestor that we know about actually lived in Western Virginia, part of that first frontier there, and actually served in a Virginia militia. I doubt he served in Clark's unit, but I don't know enough about it. So yeah, I mean, I obviously we're all implicated. I say we as European Americans in this history, and I personally, because my mother, did the work of doing this family history research. And I was involved along with her in that, and it I mean, it's, you know, it's really an enriching thing. It kind of gives you a unique window. It really helps understand if you really are able to put, you know, people that you're descended from directly into the these historical events. Anyway, that's one thing. And the other is, if these students don't know history, I mean, what a reason for, you know, ethnic studies, African American studies, indigenous studies, and the absolute necessity for that, and why it's so good that Oregon has gone in the direction of requiring that in the schools, so people don't grow up and, you know, are less prone perhaps to join the Stormfronts and the Proud Boys and these others who are just so far down on the spectrum of being brainwashed, or, you know, whatever, just being in the thrall of this master narrative of manifest destiny and white supremacy. So, yeah, I guess I was impressed by the size of that statue. I guess maybe more than the space it occupies. It's a really massive thing, and and as you say, it's quite grotesque. Anyway, those are my takes. We are asking for people to call in 503-231-8187. We had an early caller, Dave, who might have been wanting to talk about the fire. So if you could, I don't know if we're going to be talking about that, but if you do want to talk about the subject we're talking about now, please call back at 503-231-8187. Yeah, so, and the other thing, last thing, is I guess to me the flip side of the, you know, just seeing the effect of genocide and the massive early expansion of European society there, English society in that part of the country, and the forced disappearance of the native people, is the amazing persistence of the people who have survived, the Pamunkeys and the Monacans, and as you say, the Powhatans and the others, and who kept through against all odds fighting for recognition, and some of them finally achieved it only very, very recently. It's kind of an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, particularly since they were such early. I mean, I went to the museum there at Jamestown and the site there, and because it was interesting to me at the time, because I was still working on my book Standoff, and I was looking particularly at the history of the origin story, the colonial origin story of America, right, which really begins at Jamestown. And you know, Jamestown was a company town. It was started by a joint stock company called the Virginia Company of London Ventures. And these were the companies that were created to share the risk of exploration and colonization. And were given governmental powers over the lands that they were chartered to administer from the crown. And so it was really interesting to me to go and see you know, these really ancient things that they had dug up from the area, and to think that, you know, there was just a small group left. And that early meeting is really lays out the framework of what happened across the continent. You know, when you're looking at particularly at Pocahontas, is like probably one of the earliest MMIWs, missing and murdered indigenous women, and how she was taken and held hostage and raped, and then sent to London, and where she died of disease. And you know, all because she was curious about these people, Janine, and she was much younger than the Disney portrayal of her. You know, she was just a child, really. And so it's a lot of the patterns that we are dealing with today, whether you're talking about the creation of the paradigm of race that we are burdened with to this day, which are being challenged by the Black Lives Matter movement. The power structures that uphold them, you know, whether it's the white supremacy, you know, Karens, or or the police, you know, all of which came, of course, you know, many folks have traced the history of the modern police force to slave catching groups that were employed to, you know, to catch people who were trying to flee enslavement in the South, right? Places like Virginia. And so we really do have to reckon with this history in a way that's much more honest and not propaganda. I mean, these students, you know, who are at universities like the University of Virginia and the College of William and Mary, I know a lot of history. They're very, these are great. The problem is that their history is curated and is not framed in a way that is useful for really being able to analyze the pressing issues going on in their lives today, even as white students. You know, if you're going to the University of Virginia and you're a white privileged student and people are being murdered in the streets by neo-Nazis, and this is a history that is deeply tied to what happened in your, where you are being educated, right? I went to Monticello, but I could not go there. I went there, but it was really, everyone was just very, you know, they're very like, oh, look, what a wonderful life he lived, and look at his amazing, you know, how he built the house. You know, it's crazy because he built the house using his enslaved relatives, do you mean? I couldn't look at it the way that it was being kind of presented to me in the tour. You know, I was really kind of very strange and creepy, and yet the people going through were just like, oh, what a wonderful lifestyle, you know, look at his morning breakfast room and all this stuff. And then they had found where they thought that you know, of course Sally Hemings had been living, and it was just very odd. And this is really what we need to contend with, really honestly, you know, and that's not happening.
So we're halfway through the show, and I'm going to need to take a little break to talk again about KBOO and its importance and our summer fall membership drive. But it looks like Dave is back on, so let's go to our first caller. Dave, go ahead. You're on the air.
I loved her voice and everything that came with it. Can you hear me okay?
Uh-huh.
Can you? Yeah. Okay, good. I'm African American, and I also have two cousins in law enforcement. And my question to law enforcement of color is, why are they allowing the police to coddle with militia types, the ones that murder people with impunity? And I want people to constantly think about the Klan and the police. It may be a frightening thing, but I confront it as much as I can, as loudly as I can, with police, okay?
Okay.
And I want to also throw in there the white privilege of homelessness. What do I mean? I'm talking about, I was homeless once, and the minute I set my tent up where no one was bothered, no one could see me, I was harassed by company security, by joggers, by everyone until I left, okay? And I live about three blocks from an encampment that's on the sidewalk that's just ridiculous. And if I was black, that wouldn't have lasted 24 hours. That's off of Cully and Killingsworth, okay?
Okay, well, these are really important subjects, and they deserve a lot more space. We were talking about something a little bit different, but really appreciate hearing your perspective.
Agree that that's not our issue right now, really. Our issue
no,
right
it is.
Now,
I'm just saying that we're. It's really valuable for you to call in and talk about this, and I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate you giving me the time. Thank you
okay.
so much.
Thank you, Dave. And all right. Oh, as I said, we are in our membership drive, and we are not in our usual format of people calling in and making your donation or your pledge, as it were. But we are asking you to go to our website, kboo.fm, and click on donate, or just to put in kboo.fm/give/donate, or you can send us by mail to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland 97214. I guess I wanted to ask you, Jacqueline, about, you know, we've been doing this. I was trying to figure out how long we've been doing the show, and I actually wrote down a bunch of the subjects we've covered, from the Dakota Access Pipeline, of course, the Sherman-Alexie scandal, obviously the Bears' ears, you've covered quite a bit. You've written about that as well. Native electropolitics, we've covered from different angles. You've even interviewed some people. Of course, your new podcast, or relatively new, Pollen Nation, P-O-L-L-E-N, Nation. We talked about Dennis Banks and the legacy of the American Indian Movement, and so much, much more. I think 2014, you were actually first appeared as a guest on my program. And then I think over maybe the next year, we kind of, year or two, we formalized it. So it's, I think, been about 4 or 5 years. Time flies, huh?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So what's the importance of being on KBOO to you?
Well, I think I love community radio, and everywhere I've lived, I've always been, I just, you know, listen to it all the time, you know, and I think that it plays such an important role in our communities, as you noted, that it's you know, of course, a source of emergency programming as well in times like the fires going on right now here in Oregon and California and Washington. And it's but yeah, I've always enjoyed the programming. It just, people bring really talent, bring their heart to it. There's you hear things that you, in a way that you can't hear things other places. You can really sort of of course I love, you know, your show, and I love talking to you. I love, you know, getting your perspective, and it's always really great. Experience, and I'm glad that you are, you, Paul Rowland, are doing a show that really, you know, takes a look at things from a really interesting perspective, and you bring, like I said, a lot of heart to it, and I think that, it's a real gift. I think we can't really replace that, you know, because it's, you know, a community radio station is the efforts of a lot of people, and, you know, we have now things like podcasts and everything like that, but there's a way in which a community radio station is accessible to the community, is a place where people can be heard, and really, you know, in a way that's very supportive, and you provide people with access to pretty professional assistance. You know, I think the engineering production of the, you know, that's there, and everything is yeah, it's an incredible asset. And I think that many over the history, since community radio really started, it really added so much to the conversation. Of course, looking back at the early years of even Pacifica with the civil rights movement and everything, it's added so much and been a crucial part of social change.
Indeed. Thank you. Thank you for that. And so, yeah, again, spread the word is, I guess, one of the catch words of this membership drive, is let people know. We're starting to feel like sometimes with the technological changes and the sort of generational changes that, maybe fewer younger people are listening. But I think maybe that's changing a little bit. And I think maybe, our coverage of what's happening on the streets here in Portland is part of that. So, spread the word to all generations that this continues to be an incredibly vital resource for the community. Well, with that, I wanted to get back, more specifically, historical reckoning, or whatever you want to call it, that's going on, that's really jump-started so forcefully by the Black Lives Matter movement in response to this horrible drumbeat of police killings, is really reverberating throughout. You know, like just the statue removal thing. It's really forcing municipalities, states, various jurisdictions to really forcing them to grapple with it, forcing them, you know, into the city council chambers, into public discourse. The conversation is really taking place, and what's happening at the University of Virginia equally. It's the University of Virginia Racial Equity Task Force is now recommending the school remove that statue of a Revolutionary War General Clark that has been criticized for its depiction of Native Americans and replace it with an Indigenous Studies Center. And that is the result of long organizing by our friend Guy Lopez and many others, but also has probably, and Guy himself acknowledges this, has been sparked or has been taken to a whole other level by the recent uprising. So that's a very interesting dynamic. So talk about this, what you see as the importance of this, I'm just reading from this article in the Washington Post. The task force recommended to University President James Ryan that the school remove the statue and work to build a Center for Native American and Indigenous Studies. In its place, it would offer opportunities for academic studies, recruitment, and support of Native American students, including the establishment of a tribal liaison position. And I know that the Pamunkey tribe has come out in support of this, and they, you know, I think historically are very reluctant to, because of their sort of very minority and sort of embattled position there in Virginia. I know you have, you know, understand the importance of Indigenous studies and other and African studies and others in social transformation. So this seems to be a very, very important conversation that's happening there at the University of Virginia.
Yeah, I hope it can happen. I mean, it's like I said, it's happening in sort of a lot of these universities that were established in that time period and were established to basically educate and to promulgate ideas of empire, right, for the leading young men of the time period, young white men. And I think sometimes we don't reckon with how hard it is to change that whole system. And I know as an alumnus of a college that was established to do that, when I've served on alumni committees and things, I was told that basically for Native alumni to be heard, we would have to give millions of dollars to be heard. And I thought, well, you know, here we are putting our little millions in there to try to change this huge edifice that is funded by many more millions by people who don't share our opinion, right, our perspective. Wall Street folks and other really established old ruling families of this country. And I think that, how much can they be altered, really? You know, how much, it's like with the whole defund the police thing. Can we really change these structures, or are they just too, this is what they were born to do? It's like, it goes back to what in my book Standoff I look at are the origin stories of colonialism, of colonists versus Indigenous people, and that they, I characterize them being like algorithms, right? That they were created and they have these fundamental principles, and that these principles act like, if you will, if-then statements, and that they will create an outcome, and you can see the outcome with colonialism being, these very deep inequities, and of course climate change. And of course the constant threat of nuclear winter that the whole world is held under. And I don't know, like, can we tinker with these institutions? Are they actually able to change, or is this lip service? Do you know what I mean? And in the end, they go back to the very core operating instruction and where the funding is. And so I don't know. You know, I'm glad that I think that positive things can happen from that. Certainly, I think a Native Studies will have a positive impact. Part of me feels almost like, you know, that we have to actually build our own institutions. And really that experience of being told that the only way Native alumni would be heard at Dartmouth College was if we donated millions of dollars, right? And made me think, like, well, I would rather us take our millions and put them in a tribal college where we can create an institution that really reflects our what we need and our values, rather than trying to, you know, create this. I mean, Dartmouth is like basically run by fraternity. Do you mean? And these very old systems that are really hard to change, and that may really genuinely, at a certain level, not want to change. You know, and so, you know, with defund the police, that's a critique of a structure that grew out of the system that was really born in Virginia, right? And has infected and impacted the entire American enterprise, and a lot of the, you know, the first presidents were from Virginia. You know, they had a huge impact in a lot of the different, you know, sort of kind of founding documents that we turn to, and you know, the whole thing of Jefferson, you know, the sort of trying to cope with, you know, the really the two-headedness of him, the one which is all about these very high, you know, flown ideas of equality and things that we use as sort of to sort of change the system, but then the other side, which is the slaver who molested an underage girl. Do you know what I mean? As how do we, these two faces of America, you know, how do we deal with them? You know, how do we actually change what they have wrought?
Let's put that out to our listeners, 503-231-8187. We have a little less than 15 minutes left, and we do have someone who's been waiting patiently for a while. Robbie is on the air. Go ahead, Robbie.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, actually, I didn't want to I don't think it is off topic, but it's about racism and the structures that there are here. I just wanted to bring up very briefly my perspective. It's very interesting to me, this you know, discussing racism up here in Portland, Oregon. I feel it's kind of like a little bubble, and it's because, like, when I was in Arizona, I was definitely considered Mexican, Latin descent. Some people thought I was Middle Eastern, actually, when I lived down in Arizona. But when I moved up here to Portland about 10 years ago, I noticed people were, you know, people think I'm white. And it's not, you know, that's just, you know, that's how it is up here. But, you know, I experienced racial discrimination at a young age against my dad. And I'll never forget, you know, thinking, you know, about racism, you know, how you know, how it's derived from, right? And it's just ironic because I'm very aware and very, you know, and everything you're bringing up is extremely important, the systemic racism that's, you know, hidden and inside of everything and everywhere we are. But one thing that I see a lot of Portlanders lack, even on our side, you know, there's a demonstration and then there's some, you know, activists, and then there's this Asian guy walking by, and they go, "You're Andy No, like, we know what you're doing here, Andy No." And he's like, "What?" And then they're like, "Yeah, Andy No." And then he's like, "I'm not Andy No." And then they're like, "Oh, well, you know what you're doing here, looking like him." And he's like, "Being Asian?" And it's what I see in our side is we're forgetting that, like, I you know, and I've had a lot of, it's probably an unpopular opinion up here in Portland, but what I see with, you know, racism is, there is, like, yeah, there is definitely systemic racism that needs to be addressed and communicated, but it all stems from racial discrimination, which I think a lot of Portlanders are kind of like forgetting. It's judging somebody based off of their race, And it's just so weird because I was talking to a lot of my white friends who come up here, you know, and, you know, they're very, they consider themselves anti-racist, but then I watched this behavior get switched around, and it's just so confusing to me because I feel, and when I talk to black people about this, or especially BIPOC people, you know, it's, they all have kind of the same understanding. It's like, how can you judge somebody without knowing them? But on the other front, now it's like we're only addressing this and then also now becoming stereotyping in the same process. And so it was something that I wanted to add into the conversation because I feel it's making me really frustrated seeing Portland kind of come down to this, boil down to this, and they're not addressing, you know, they're not doing the work is what I see.
Okay. Any response, Jackie?
Thank him for his comments. I think that's something I noticed as well coming to Portland, Oregon, is that this is the one of the whitest cities, I think. Is it the whitest city west of the Mississippi or something? And I sometimes feel, and I've discussed this on the show before, that maybe white people come here to get away from the complexity of race in their lives. And of course, you know, there's been a lot of reporting on the history of Oregon as a sort of white haven, a white supremacist haven, that was put into the Constitution of the state, and that a lot of the people who came to Oregon to settle it were from the South, leaving the South after the Civil War, white people, and were bringing these ideas with them, and so. You know, it was actually a white utopia. Some even progressive people who come here to a certain extent, I wonder, you know, do they come here partly so they can just enjoy their whiteness without having to think about anything else, you know, the other more troubling issues? And I know that sounds terrible out of context. We've had much longer conversations about how I came to kind of question this over the years, but it is something that I actually had a writing instructor here in Portland, and I was bringing up with him issues of how women were not being represented in being published in articles and things. There's this group called VIDA, VIDA, and they put out the numbers. They run the numbers every year of how many women were published in different outlets and stuff, and he was like, he dismissed that concern that women were not being published enough. And then he talked about how growing up being white in Texas in a majority Hispanic or, you know, Latinx community, that he felt oppressed. And that, you know, and I was telling him, and I was like, you know, but you live here in Portland now. You could move away from it. And you chose to live in a community where you were part of the majority. You know, we don't really have those choices. You know, I mean, those choices, you know, I mean, even apparently, even if most of the women working in publishing are white women, they're still going to choose to publish white men. You know, it's hard to get away from this kind of issue. And so the privilege of being able to move away from the problem, to leave it, you know, that is an invocation of white privilege and showing preference and a greater comfort level in a society created by white supremacy.
Well, I just want to thank Robbie for calling. We only have about 6 or 7 minutes left. 503-231-8187, maybe two more callers if you want to get your call in. I did forget to mention, maybe too late now, but KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio is my Facebook page, and I can interact with people through that. Please like that page. And you can communicate with me any other time as well. KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio on Facebook. I am Paul Roland. I am the weekly host of Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm speaking with Jacqueline Keeler, a Dakota and Diné writer and activist who lives in the Portland area, who is my second Wednesday co-host, and we always have some really interesting deep dives into whatever subject we're talking about. And today we're talking about George Rogers Clark in particular, and more generally this time of a historical reckoning and how it's playing out in various places, in this case at the University of Virginia, which has a very important place in the history, along with the state of Virginia, as you've heard. And if you didn't hear all that, you should go back and listen to it at kboo.fm, where all our shows are archived. So they're going to have the vote this Friday on that on the George Rogers Clark statue. And I just realized there's also going to be, they've been having a series of demonstrations organized by some local activists there in Charlottesville. And I guess I should read this since I just got sent this reminder. Thursday, 6 p.m., that's tomorrow, there will be an indigenous-led rally at the George Rogers Clark Genocide Trophy, is how it's referred, near the University of Virginia corner. The protest is part of a long campaign to pressure the UVA Board of Visitors, who will be meeting Thursday and Friday, to take down the hideous Conqueror of the Northwest statue, give the land it sits on to a Native American foundation, build an indigenous study center on the same site, so I guess that is what they're asking for, and create an office that will formally work to consult with Native nations, tribes, and other communities on future university matters. Please join Native American comrades in amplifying their call. Invite trusted friends, allies, accomplices, and comrades. That's quite a note for tomorrow if you happen to be in the Charlottesville, Virginia area. But this is a an important thing. You're talking, Jackie, about the, you know, the sort of the disappearance, the lack of strong visibility of Native people, especially there in the middle Atlantic states, and further south and further north, there's of course the Iroquois up north. So that anybody who lives there actually does have have some interaction perhaps with a real traditional, large traditional Native community. But there, so this, you know, this kind of thing, these kind of demonstrations give visibility, just like the demonstrations that tearing down the Columbus statues, which happened in Richmond and other places. This is their moment in terms of this period of historical reckoning. That's not really a question. Any further thoughts?
Yeah, I hope it happens. I mean, I think it is very, you know, of course these coastal communities, whether you're talking about California and or Virginia and the New England states and all these things, the level of genocide was really high, you know, much higher than in the interior. It's very, very chilling. I think Americans, you know, to the extent Americans don't contend with the fact that they're living on a graveyard, you know, and going about their daily lives like it never happened. It's pretty striking. I think it's something that that Americans need to deal with in a much more honest way. And because only if we can reframe these things, the history, in a way that's actually meaningful and useful to address the issues at hand, the issues of white supremacy, of the ways in which it diminishes the ability of people to live their lives, to use their talents. I mean, I often point out the fact that, you know, what have we lost in all this, you know, with this system of white supremacy? What, you know, what kind of things have we lost? And, you know, when you take people and you enslave them I prefer to call folks like Thomas Jefferson slavers, and maybe that's not totally correct, but it calls more to the action of what they were doing every day, slavers, you know, and not to call, you know, people who were enslaved just slaves, because that sort of limits their humanity. I mean, that these were people who were stolen and held in bondage in active ways, and I think that we've lost so much in that. I mean, who knows what, you know, some young girl born into being enslaved by Thomas Jefferson, maybe she could have been a brilliant we've lost all kinds of talent. You know, we could have solved cancer. I mean, who knows what even people are being held in poverty today, you know, with their options diminished, you know, what they don't ability to, you know, what they can't do. They can't go to the College of Women, University of Virginia. They can't have access to these powerful people to push their career forward, you know, or even the economic divide where, you know, the average white family has, you know, what, 100 and some thousand times more wealth, accumulated wealth, like, and, you know, it's not times, but they have, like, you know, about 10 times the accumulated wealth of the average black family. Well, that means that at every educational level, even the college level, and that means that those families, they don't have the time and the energy and the, you know, to be able to do other things, you know, besides get by. And what could they have done if they had that access to those resources? You know, people do things when they have the time to do them. You know,
well, those penetrating questions, we're going to have to leave it there, Jackie. Thank you once again. We are flush out of time. Thank you so much, Jacqueline Keeler.
Definitely. Thank you.
All right. Okay, we'll be talking again in a month, and I'll be with you next week. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Bye-bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. We feature interviews with leaders in the community focusing on issues important to Washington County.
Today, our show was taped during the volatile